2 was an exciting time for women. We were needed in many jobs only open to men previously. It was the time America became accepting of aviation as a normal and fast transportation for the first time. I learned to fly in 1940. Made a very spectacular flight to Alaska in 1942 that was covered by the Associated Press. It was a two-seater Taylor craft, and it was sheer ignorance that made us do this. Anyhow, one of my ground school students, I was teaching ground school at Carroll College in Waukesha, and he was given a plane when he finished my course by his father, and we decided we'd fly around the country together and see it. So we flew to his cousin in Nevada, never found him, and to my sister in Seattle, who was an intern there, and she was a year younger than I was, in a dietetics intern at the hospital there. And then we looked at the map, and it looked as if Alaska was only 1,500 miles north along the coast, and we said, we're going to Alaska. And we discovered, of course, when we got there, that we wouldn't be allowed to go to Alaska in a land plane. That we had to have a seaplane and a big one to get through the ocean. So we went the back way, and we flew to Prince George first, or we didn't fly. Yes, we flew all the way, of course. We flew to St. George first, which was on a river that had started in Vancouver and went north. Hope went north. And then we flew from there to Telegraph Creek, which was a place without a telegraph system. And we were caught there by bad weather a couple times. We tried to get out, we couldn't. And finally a bush pilot came along and said, you can't go that way, you have to go the roundabout way, and you go behind Telegraph Creek, which was a little tiny Indian town on the edge of a big river, Stickeen River, yeah, I think so. And we went behind that, and there was a flat plain that had been used as an airport. So we flew, he said, and fly very low over that, so that you could see the profile of two mountains on the other end of it. And you want to go through that, and there's the river that'll lead you to the next river that will take you up to a White Horse, which was in the Yukon. So we got up, we did that perfectly. And as we flew over this plain, there were at least 10,000 caribou below us. It was incredible. Of course, we scared them all. But anyhow, we got up to the wedge in the mountain and found the river and followed that one until it became a bigger river in Atlin, British Columbia. And then we flew from there up to White Horse in the Yukon. And in the Yukon, let's see, and we had to fly to, what was the famous gold country, gold city in the Yukon? With your history, you might remember.
I'm not sure. Have to think about it.
It was north.
No.
And it was parallel to Fairbanks, Alaska. So we made our entry into Alaska at Fairbanks. Glad to be back in the U.S. with its beam. The navigation radio at that time consisted of a beam that led to all the major cities. And on one side of it, it went dot dash. And on the other side of it, it said dash dot. When it was merged, that was the beam that led you to the city.
Oh,
So we got on that beam and we landed in Fairbanks. And that was in 1940 in August. And from there we went down to, past the great big mountain, Mount McKinley, 2,300 feet high. Passed it, not under it, but way under it, but on another, we were over the railroad, and went to Anchorage. And because my newspaper back home, the Milwaukee Journal, wanted me to check up on a body of very poor people from northern Wisconsin that had been transplanted up there. They were farmers, and they were hoping that they could make this area into a farmland, and they did. It had very short summers, but long, long winters, you know, daylight saving all the time, daylight all the time. And they raised the first vegetables, and fortunately when the new air base Anchorage was built, they supplied the food for the people there and became very, very substantial. They actually carved out of the wilderness the farmland at a tip of an iceberg. And it was watered all the time in the summer. And they grew pansies that big, but also cabbages this big. And it was a very successful experiment. They had all been so poor, and it led them to have families, and I interviewed them. And then I went back to Fairbanks, and I said to myself, and to Gene, he was the owner of the plane, Gene Damrow. He was 19, I was 22, and I said, we can't leave here without going up into the Arctic Circle. So we went up to Fort Yukon on the Yukon River, and it was only coming home from that we hit the terrible weather. But we had been told in Seattle that we would have several weeks of good weather if we went then, and that's why we went when we went. And we barely got home, back to Fairbanks, and then barely got down to Vancouver. Just barely, if our plane hadn't been so little that we could go deep in a canyon that it was making, and the river was making, and turn and dodge the sides, and we landed at Hope first, which we knew was there, an emergency field. And we went west then to Vancouver, down to Seattle, and home. And that's the first time I was in Billings. We landed in Billings to, so grateful, because they had one of the few airports with a little lighting on the runways. Nothing fancy, but enough that we were there right after dark, and that enabled us to land. We didn't stay, but at least that was Billings, my first visit. And then we got back to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I was interviewed by so many different groups about this flight. And also, it was printed. The Associated Press had followed it all the way. And I got a letter from Life magazine, the New Life in New York, asking if I'd come and be their aviation editor during World War II. So that was from 1942 to 47. I was aviation editor of Life magazine. And it was when America didn't think flying was feasible. Most mothers still thought that their sons would be killed by planes falling out of the sky, because their only recognition of flying was with the brainstorm, not brain, but what do they call it? Some kind of stormers who came to their fairs and did acrobatics in Aquadude Land. Wrong. Crash.
Yeah.
And so my job was to try to make aviation a reasonable thing for these women, these mothers. And they responded. By the end of the war, America was definitely air-minded. I was at Life in New York City then, or out of New York City all the time. I was going to Air Force bases all over the country, especially as new airplanes were built and introduced. And my main stories would be getting a good air picture with a photographer of the airplane and then explaining how it fit a certain need for the war that was going on. By that time, the U.S. had gotten over its neutrality, and that was after Pearl Harbor, and was full force. But up till then, they had been doing lease lend to our allies to help them. And there was a wonderful story there that I was never allowed to print because it was still dangerous. And that was about the women pilots who were flying. They would fly the new, brand new P-39s, very fast fighter plane, no, only one seat, and fly them to Buffalo, from Buffalo, where they were made, to Great Falls, Montana. And their Russian fighter pilots, girl fighter pilots, would pick them up and take them up through Alaska and across Siberia to the front in what are some of their big cities in Russia?
In Russia?
St. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg.
Yeah, which was then called something else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was under the Russian communism management, but they were so glad to get those planes that because we finally sent them over 1,000 of them, and they helped them. They could not only fight in the air, but they could aim at the tanks from Germany that were threatening their cities and just knock them out with one good shot. So they had those, and that was a wonderful story, I thought, about women. But I couldn't print it, and until after the war, of course. Then that was 1942, and that's when I went to Life. And Life sent me a letter inviting me to come to New York City and be their aviation editor, because there was a lot of confusion about what the pictures they were getting from the front were, which airplanes they were, and all this. And that was one of my main jobs, just to identify all the planes, and then to go around and get profiles of the new planes that were coming out. And it was a wonderful job. At the end, however, they fired me because it was over, and the men were all coming back. They all wanted to work for Life. But also, nobody minded. We were so glad to see the men coming back. And then I was lucky enough to have Shell Oil Company ask me to do public relations for them for women, mm-hmm. because women had been learning to drive cars mm-hmm. when their husbands were away and everybody else. And I did this little column called Tips on Touring. It was in at least 200 weekly little newspapers, or big ones. And my name was Carol Lane for that. Mm-hmm. And it told women how to pack their suitcases and how to look for good places to take their kids that were close to home so they could go on little weekend trips. And how to keep those kids happy in the back seat. And, you know, there were no seat belt requirements or anything at that time. So it was an exciting time to do that. And I met my husband finally in the rooming house where he had come to, why were we both in the same rooming house? Oh, it was a miniature estate up in Westchester County, very elegant area that was letting career people rent a room. And we both wound up there. And he was, let's see, I have to get this straight because I've got so many generations here to think about. My husband, Les, was a chemical engineer and working for W.R. Grace by that time, I guess. Or, no, for U.S. Rubber. And then that went out of business in Providence, and he worked for W.R. Grace, which everybody out here hates, but it was a wonderful company, and they still are paying my pension from him. Pretty nice. And what happened to me then? Oh, I stayed home for 15 years and had my kids. I had Karen, Terry, and John. And then after he had that transition to make from U.S. Rubber to W.R. Grace, we moved to Boston. And I decided I better learn how to make some money again. So I went back to University of Boston and got my master's and became a professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. And after that, the kids were growing up. What was I doing next? Sorry to waste your time here.
Not at all.
After that, I had that job. I got the job with Northeastern, which lasted just 7 years. And by that time, you know, I was in my 50s, and they didn't think they should give me tenure. So my church, in 1978, the church, the Lutheran church, which I belonged to all my life, grabbed me to edit a first report for and then edit its area newspaper, New England Lutheran. And I did that until I was 75 and retired officially. But that was a wonderful job too. I got to know all the pastors in New England, and they still write to me, which is kind of nice when I'm stuck out here. But anyhow, my son brought me out here after I'd had a terrible fall on my kitchen floor and was in a nursing home out there. And he came to see me and was appalled at the situation of a nursing home, which was the best one available, but my bed was about that far from the next bed. And that next bed had a big television she'd gotten, had it on day and night, and I really found it hard to sleep, but not too hard because my hearing was pretty bad anyway. But anyhow, that was May 6th last year, and I've been here ever since. And I've been toying with the idea of trying to write a story of over 85. See, I'm 87 now. And how you can still have a very happy, busy life. And I do have. I have things like you coming, other people coming, and my colleagues around here, they're all fascinating. Some of them are much sicker than I am. My problem is my back. And through it all, my back got a curve in it about like that. And so it doesn't function too well. It hurts. But only when I'm not lying down. So that's why I lie down all the time. Simple. And I did that until I was 75. Mm-hmm. So if you add up 75 and 1918, you'd know what year that was. I think it was something like 92 maybe. And you see me as I am today. I have my son, Terry, here, his wife, Jill, who has been very kind to me and is interesting. And she won the Billings Award for the best PTA president. She'd founded a PTA in this little poor school in a poor part of town and got them to raise $40,000 to build a playground for the kids. And she was cited by the city for that. And she loves that work, so my son won't let her take money because he said it'd ruin his income tax. But she goes back and works there every morning. I can't leave it to that little school and helps them. And it's a school that just definitely needs her help. Mm-hmm. They have 6 kids there with diabetes. Mm-hmm. I have to watch them all the time, you know. And all sorts of other problems. She and my son often deliver Christmas trees to families that don't have them and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very exciting time to be here. I don't see very much of them. And they have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old mm-hmm. now, who are delightful children. The older one is a real student and has been on this. She's a sophomore at West High, and she is on the student council. And the younger one is a pretty good student too. I mean, she's still an AV student, but she likes sports, and she plays baseball, and she does jumps hurdles. So that's the story of my life.
The story of your life.
Well,
I'm very interested in what your life was like around and during World War II.
Yeah.
When did you first hear about Pearl Harbor? Where were you?
Where did I first hear about what?
When you first heard about Pearl Harbor, do you remember where you were?
I don't. Okay. I'm one of those terrible people who never made that a landmark.
That's
oh,
all
half
right.
The country made it mm-hmm. their reference mm-hmm. point for everything. Mm-hmm.
When did you decide to join the military? You said that you joined for a little while before
yes.
Life magazine called you up.
Uh-huh. Well, I had been at Life at that time,
okay.
You see. And it was, and I felt it was my duty to give back mm-hmm. this wonderful flying training mm-hmm. I'd had from them. Mm-hmm. See, I was admitted to a civilian pilot training program
okay.
that the government began in 1991, and they just wanted boys. So when I went to register, it was being implemented by the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. I went over to that, which I had graduated in Madison, but this was a branch of it, and said, oh, I want to join that class. And they said, oh, it's just for boys. I said, well, put my name down. You may need me. And lo and behold, the day before the course began, they called and said, you want to learn to fly? They had 14 boys, and they had to have 15 to get the contract.
Wow.
So I was the 15th.
Mm-hmm. What was the response of the other men in the program? Were they
they never minded. I was a real tomboy at that point. And we had a good time dancing and drinking Cokes on the days that the weather was bad when we were trying to learn to fly, you know. They were always very kind to me. And I wrote to a couple of them until very recently when they died. And they got along with me fine.
And what year was that?
Hmm?
And what year was that?
That was 1992. That's when that course began. And then after that, what year was what?
I was just wondering what year you started your flying and started...
Yeah, the flying was in 1990.
1990?
Yes.
Okay.
And then 1940.
Okay.
1940
okay.
was the flying.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I got my license.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had other courses mm-hmm. after that, government sponsored. Mm-hmm. They needed 20 graduates of the first course for the next one, which was acrobatic flying in an open biplane.
Okay.
And they got 19. They called me and said, hey, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was wonderful. And then they had one called the apprentice instructor class in flying paper cubs. Up till then, I'd been flying a side-by-side tailor crab. And that's what my friend bought, of course. And it was a lovely little plane with a wheel instead of a stick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned how to fly the Piper Cub and train other pilots. But I never got an instructor's license. You know, sometimes you have an experience that convinces you that you're not a natural pilot. And I had several of those. One of them was when I started flying, I got sick every flight. So that my instructor gave up on me, but they appointed another one who was very good to me. And he babied me along, and I no longer got sick, and I learned to fly, and I passed my flight exam. Of course, it was very easy for me to do the written work that you had to do, so I decided after I'd gotten my, finished that second course that I could teach. And having a degree, you know, and all. So I taught aviation ground school at Carroll College and Milwaukee School of Engineering, their first woman employee ever, and at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And then, let's see, that's when Life wrote me a letter from New York to come to New York and be their aviation editor. So that's how that all developed.
What was your experiences like teaching aviation?
It was very exciting. I taught navigation, meteorology, civil air regulations, and the thing I wasn't very good at was engines.
Mm-hmm.
But my kids were all boys who loved cars, and they would help me, and I got them through that part of it, mm-hmm. their test too.
Mm-hmm.
My classes loved. I mean, they were all people who wanted to learn to fly, and
mm-hmm.
they had to pass this written test mm-hmm. to do it. And I started with night school at my high school, and then I was hired by those colleges to be their one of their teachers. So I loved teaching. Kids were all eager to learn. It was a wonderful situation.
And when you did decide that you would like to join the military, what branch were you looking at?
The Army Air Force.
Oh, okay, Army Air Force.
Yeah,
okay.
That's what I applied to and was accepted in. This was a new little flying group that Jacqueline Cochran, a very famous pilot in those days, she'd won lots of speed records and everything, was developing for the Army Air Force so that we have a backlog of women to ferry planes across the country. There were also women at that time under Nancy Love who were very experienced pilots, and they were actually flying bombers to England on the lease land thing.
Okay.
So it was a very exciting time for aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the war, people took it for granted you could fly.
Mm-hmm.
Up till then, they thought it was too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And their mothers were so worried about their sons being assigned mm-hmm. to the Air Force. Oh, it was terrible.
So what were your feelings when they had you stay at the magazine instead of fly.
Well, they gave me a reward. They said you could go down and do the first story at Sweetwater, Texas, on the group that you wanted to join. And it was so happened that my best friend from home and I were joining together. So they bunked me with her, and I had 2 weeks of flying with the girls, and that was pretty exciting. I have a wonderful picture of that. And then I came home, and my assignments were so exciting. I went to all, and you know, they were just developing real airplanes, and until then they'd just been fabric-covered wings with sprayed with stiffener. And the one I took my acrobatic flying in was like that. Mm-hmm. And now they had the DC-3. Are you familiar with that? Well, that's the small airliner that's still in use today.
Oh, okay.
They had developed, Douglas had made that in the late 1930s. Mm-hmm. And it was a precursor of metal airplanes. And all the new ones, all the military ones, of course, were metal. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to different air bases and find out why they designed this one for what. Like there were four-engine planes, the B-17 and the B-24. That's the B-24. And I got to fly that. And just as in the passenger seat, not in the passenger seat, but in the co-pilot seat. And everywhere I went, of course, all the pilots were very young. And very thrilled to have a girl pilot with them. And then I flew the B-25, which is a two-seater, two-engine, B-26, which was a very hot two-engine plane. I flew with a hero crew from that. They had come back from Africa, and they wanted me to see how fast it was. We flew down about 100 feet off the ground and you could hardly see the ground, it went by so fast.
Wow.
And that was to Indianapolis. Their PR man, who was taking them around, wouldn't fly with them. And there I sat in the co-pilot seat when we landed in Indianapolis. He was so mad. Anyhow, it was a wonderful plane, but it was very tricky to fly. And they discovered that they had a big typo bullet that went right through the propeller center so that you could shoot that, and they found it was a wonderful anti-tank plane.
Oh.
And they used it for that lots of times. It was a very exciting plane. And then finally the B-29 was designed. That was the last of the conventional engine planes. I never got to fly, and I flew that. I never got to fly a jet, which they were coming in now. That would have been fun.
Yeah.
But by that time, I was off on my church job, and it was a different type of writing I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But being a journalist was like an eye-opener to the world.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you remember the most when you were doing journalism?
When I was being a journalist?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I told you the story about the story they wouldn't print because it was censored. That's the one that really sticks in my head. It was so exciting, and when I moved to Montana, it was just incredible that up the road at Great Falls is where they made that transfer from the Russian pilots to vice versa, from American girl pilots to Russian girl pilots.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the best story I had at that time. But let's see. My work with the church was very rewarding too. I tried very hard to spotlight the parishes that were doing unusual things. and there were quite a few of them. And let's see. I didn't think of that, but I did think you might be interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
This little article about what we did at home, what homemakers had to do during World War II.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah.
What homemakers had to do during World War II?
Well, it turned out that we were rationed,
mm-hmm.
and we had to figure out how to cook differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a homemaker too, in addition to, you know, I had to eat and didn't always eat out. That was one of the things, and let's see, what else did we do? I'm trying to think what was in short supply. I remember one experience. I'd found this nice recipe from my mother about making scalloped potatoes, and the real key to the taste was to have bacon on the top. And I went to the butcher and I said, I need a little piece of bacon, a strip.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you don't have your ration card with you. And I hadn't thought about that. So finally I told him I had this new recipe this old one that was my mother's, and he finally gave me a half a piece. And it didn't make the difference.
Yes.
That was one of my cooking experiences. What else does it say there? There's something else too.
This looks like it says, revisit the inventiveness of World War II housewives in dealing with rationing, short ages, and learning trades key to the war effort.
So now we've gotten to Rosie the Riveter.
Yes.
And there were Rosie the Riveters all over the place that had been hired in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the mother of one of my colleagues here.
Mm-hmm.
Was a Rosie the Riveter there.
Okay.
And was praised for being so good.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an article about them. It's in here. Uh-oh, don't let any of that fall out. Yeah, you could mail that for me if you would.
I would.
I see. Oh no, it isn't written yet. Did I give you one today at mail?
Nope.
Must be this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That one I have finished.
Mm-hmm.
It's just renewal. Rosie the Riveter clipping. Here it is. This was in the paper just a couple weeks ago and reminded me of, unfortunately, it was last Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And last Sunday's jump for it, I lost. I have a person here who recycles the papers, and I had given them to her
mm-hmm.
without remembering that I had to get the second part of that. But these happened to be in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And all over the country, they were doing boats, and most of them were doing airplanes, mm-hmm. though. The one, her mother, who was doing airplanes in Chicago, she said she visited here and flew in one of those airplanes that she had done the riveting for, or like the DC-3, a regular airliner. And she said, I'll never fly in that plane again. The rivets are all getting loose.
Noticed.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
But she did. Her daughter took her home and she had to go in it. But nonetheless, why, she felt the rivets, you could hear them rattling.
Mm-hmm.
And that was dangerous, mm-hmm. she thought.
Mm-hmm.
But that Rosie the Riveter was a real phenomena of World War II. They just needed them. They needed women for every kind of work that men usually did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why I was so lucky to be aviation editor of life, because
mm-hmm.
all the men were gone.
Mm-hmm.
But there I was with all my knowledge of aviation and all my knowledge of flying. And,
mm-hmm.
and they just, life got brought me to New York, and I never got away from the East after that.
Mm-hmm.
Except for visits home once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful, wonderful job. But then that ended with my marriage, because the reason that I wanted to get married so badly by that time was I wanted children, and I was 31. Mm-hmm. I was getting along. Mm-hmm. So that's what my husband and I started doing, raising a daughter and two sons. Mm-hmm. In Rhode Island, which was a nice place to live. Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, yeah, I like your name as Jennifer Lynn. I think it's much prettier that way.
Okay.
But if you ever have a byline, I'd use it all.
Okay.
It's such a short last name that it's easy to forget it.
Yes.
And I'm so glad you came. I was afraid you might not come.
Oh.
You can have that.
Oh, thank you.
You can have that.
Okay. Thank you.
To remind you of what I was trying to say.
Thank you.
Maybe I didn't get it all said. I don't know.
Thank you.
It's on.
All right. What were your perceptions of the war and who was fighting the war before the United States got involved?
Well, I knew we were doing all that. Les Lindy, what do they call it?
Lend-Lease?
Lindy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Les Lindy. It was called something else.
Oh.
It's in one of these, I think. No? Lease Lindy. Mm-hmm. Lease Lindy. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. And I felt it was kind of too bad we didn't just jump in and help them wholeheartedly, because they were in such terrible straits, you know. They were bombing England to pieces, and our planes made a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. They were faster than the Spitfire. Faster than the Spitfire, and they were faster than the German planes. And more maneuverable, and better protected for the pilots. Mm-hmm. So that was exciting. Mm-hmm. And another, I know what I was going to tell you. One of these women who were teaching Jacqueline Cochran's women pilots, mm-hmm, was a very good pilot. She taught men, and then she came over and taught the women. And she wrote a wonderful book. Her name was Sally Knapp, K-N-A-P-P, and she also was an early grad of that CPTY program that I was in, not mine, but another one in the country, and she wound up teaching men pilots and wanting to get ahead on the Army Air Forces. And then she finally wound up flying for Jacqueline Cochran's program in Sweetwater, Texas. In 1946, she wrote a book called New Wings for Women, presenting biographies of 13 women in jobs related to aviation. They included United States' Teddy Kenyon, who's the one who helped me start a program of women pilots called the 99s in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And a test pilot of the Grumman Hellcat fighter that played up there. Now that's a fighter plane that took off of aircraft carriers.
Okay.
And she was a test pilot.
Okay.
Yeah, that's after the Pearl Harbor attack.
Okay.
By Japanese. Others were a weather bureau meteorologist, Nancy Love's ferry pilots delivering bombers to England, a British plane designer, a flight nurse stewardess, a Canadian flight instructor, me, aviation editor of the popular Big Size Life magazine, the personnel director of Canada's Women Aircraft, workers, a Rosie the Riveter, a Russian combat pilot, a government flight instructor, and the aeronautical engineer at United Airlines. All women. Isn't that something? Let me show you that book. My daughter, I sent my daughter a copy back in the, let's see, when did I figure I sent it? A long time ago. Anyhow, she Xeroxed the whole book for me. And you'll find my chapter in that.
Copy of this.
Page 100, I think. Maggie, I'll give you your grooming in a little bit.
Did your family have any particular political leanings?
We lived in a Republican town,
mm-hmm.
and they were definitely Democrats. Mm-hmm. They were rebels, so mm-hmm. I guess I inherited that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, my mother was just thrilled when I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And she would fly with me anytime I'd mm-hmm. give her a chance. And my father, who I thought would be so thrilled, was afraid. He flew with me once and that's all. Isn't that funny to guess?
Now, was anybody else in your family? Did you have siblings or anybody that was in the military?
No. I had one sister,
mm-hmm.
and she was a dietitian,
mm-hmm.
and didn't ever work that mm-hmm. way though. She got married and had kids.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She didn't really like it, but she wanted to get as far from me as she could. Now that did you remember 30 Seconds Over Tokyo? A very famous book. When our team flew off of a carrier,
mm-hmm.